This is October 14, 2022, in Gita Nagari on Finding Happiness.
So, welcome. Is everybody interested to find some happiness?
Yes.
All right. So that's what we want in life, isn't it? We want joy. Exuberance. Yes. Some people live their whole life hoping it's just around the corner. And some people actually are living in joy. Now we're going to look at two categories of happiness. And really there are many subcategories, but we're not going to get into that today. We're just going to look in a general way at material happiness and spiritual happiness. All right, you all ready for our journey?
Yes.
Can you all reasonably see me? And can everybody hear me?
Yes.
All right. And I have background music. We tried to get everything set up nicely before the presentation, but if you feel the background music is too loud, please just raise your hand and tell me and we'll adjust it, all right? Okay. So what do we mean by material happiness? So it's explained in the ancient wisdom literature of the Vedas that often what we call material happiness is related to basic bodily demands, which can be analyzed as eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. And often we define happiness in terms of those four, physically, mentally, and emotionally. We'd like to look at a verse here from the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 5, text 22. Yehi samsparshaja bhoga dukha yonaya evate ad antan vantara kanteya na teshu ramate buddha. Now we have some very interesting Sanskrit words here. Samsparsha. Sparsha means touch. Now this doesn't just mean skin touch, but all of our senses touch sense objects. Our eyes touch light, our ears touch sound waves, our tongue touches food, our nose touches fragrance, our mind touches ideas. So samsparsha ja, ja means birth, like janma. So these are happiness are born from touch. Bhoga means happiness. So a happiness that is born from touch, from the touch of the senses, the physical senses, or the touch of the mind to some object. Dukkha yonaya. Yoni means the source of birth. And dukkha means misery. Happiness, which is born from a sense of touch, gives birth to misery. So buddha means intelligent people. Rama means enjoyment. Intelligent people do not enjoy something which gives birth to misery. So here is a translation by our founder and my spiritual teacher, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. He translates this verse, as an intelligent person does not take part in the sources of misery which are due to contact with the material senses. O son of Kunti, such pleasures have a beginning and an end, and so the wise does not delight in them. The reason it says, O son of Kunti, is this is a conversation between Krishna and Arjuna, whose mother's name was Kunti. So this is one way of understanding what we mean by material happiness. Material happiness is really pleasure, material pleasure, where one of our senses touches an object that we consider favorable. Now, obviously, an object I consider favorable, you may not consider favorable, right? There are foods that I like that you may find revolting, and vice versa, or artwork that you like and I don't like, and music that I like and you don't like, and so forth. But the main thing here is that they are a source of misery, and they are only coming from the body and the mind. Now, this next quote from the Srimad Bhagavatam, also called the Bhagavat Purana 7742, is, I think, one of the most fascinating concepts. This particular verse was spoken by a great saint who was a very little boy, and his name was Prahlad, for those of you familiar with the narration. And he said, one is happy as long as one does not endeavor for happiness. As soon as one begins his activities for happiness, his conditions of distress begin. Now that seems counterintuitive. Now as we go on in the second half of this presentation to what is spiritual happiness, we'll understand that our spiritual happiness is something we already have within us. And so therefore, as soon as one is looking for happiness, one is denying what one already has. The very looking for it implies that one does not have it, and sets about within one an illusion of emptiness and an illusion of want and an illusion of need, which then becomes the source of all the distress in material happiness. Now we're going to analyze this material happiness, which is from the contact of the senses or the mind with their object, and which is motivated by a search for something we believe we don't already have. So how does this act as dukkha yonaya? How does this act as the source of misery? Well, this contact of the senses with their object is in one sense just a mitigation of distress. For example, if I'm hungry, I'm happy by eating, but if I'm not hungry, I'm not happy by eating. Right? The same food, if I'm not hungry, doesn't make me happy. So what's making me happy is my mitigation of hunger. Does that make sense to everybody? The same with going to sleep. You know, when I was a kid, sometimes it's a punishment, you know, go to your bed. I remember when I had chicken pox, and I wasn't really very sick at all, but my parents had a party, and I wasn't allowed to be with the guests, so I wouldn't get any of them sick. But I was told I had to stay in bed, although I felt fine. You know, and to me it was a punishment. You have to stay in your room, and you have to stay in bed. But now if I'm really tired, sleeping is a great pleasure, isn't it? Ah. I have to sleep. And if you think of any material pleasure, it's like that. This fact of material pleasure is the reason why people try to increase their sense of distress before engaging in a material pleasure. Can you think about this for a minute? People try to increase their sense of distress, increase their sense of need, increase their sense of desire before engaging in that pleasurable activity. Because the activity is only pleasurable as much as it mitigates distress. Once it's mitigated the distress, the activity is no longer pleasurable. Does this make sense in everybody's experience? So there has to be distress first in order for the experience to appear pleasurable. That's a pretty raw deal, isn't it? In order to enjoy this thing, I have to first feel a need for it. I have to first feel the absence of it. I have to first feel desire for it. The thing in and of itself cannot give me pleasure unless I'm feeling its absence. The problem is, it also often causes distress. I eat too much, I get a stomachache. Right? I enjoy things I shouldn't be enjoying, they're illegal or immoral or whatever, and I get some disease, or I get in trouble with the law, or I get in trouble with my relationships. A lot of the things we enjoy, not only do they require distress to experience them in the first place, but then they cause distress. Therefore, we tend to take material happiness in moderation. If we take too much of it, we end up with other problems. So I call this a distress sandwich. You have to suffer before you can enjoy something, and the enjoyment itself causes suffering. You know, you've got to kind of balance these things really carefully. Like, I've got to make sure that I have enough desire for the thing that it's pleasurable, and I've got to make sure I don't enjoy too much of the thing, because otherwise I'm going to suffer afterwards. Then it also diminishes with experience. So let's say you really like pizza, and you have pizza for breakfast, and you have pizza for lunch, and you have pizza for breakfast, and for lunch, and for dinner, and for breakfast, and for lunch, and for dinner, and for breakfast, and for lunch, and for dinner, and for breakfast, and for lunch, and for dinner. The pleasure you get from it diminishes the more you experience it. We have a Hare Krishna temple in Detroit, which was built by Lawrence Fisher of Body by Fisher with cars. And he put 24 karat gold in the floors. Now, who does that? It's kind of a stupid place to put 24 karat gold. It's gotten worn off everywhere except the edges. And I mean, the place is like, there's hand-tooled leather in the ceiling, there's rare Venetian glass in the pillars. I mean, the place is incredible. Every single square inch of that place is a work of art. And I used to give tours there, so people come, you give them tours, and they're all, whoa, oh, well, you know, but we saw the place every day. And you see the place every day, you really don't notice the 24 karat gold in the floor and the hand-tooled leather in the ceiling. It's just the ceiling, and it's just the floor. And this is true with almost everything in our lives, right? You get that new car, you get that new computer, you get that something, you get that, and after a while, it's just what you have. The psychologists have studied this. This is true with material pain, too. Like they say, you know, people come into a lot of money and inheritance or the lottery, and after about 6 months, they're back to about the same level of happiness they were before. And, you know, someone gets an accident, they get paralyzed, and within about 6 months, they're back to the same level of happiness that they were before. We become accustomed. It just kind of, it becomes boring. Now, that's not the worst of it. It can actually become revolting. So I read a story once about this man who was a teenager, worked in an ice cream parlor. And one of the perks was that he could have as much ice cream as he wanted. So being a teenager, he ate a lot of ice cream. And he ate so much ice cream that it started to nauseate him. But he continued to eat ice cream, and he said, to this day, I don't know how old he was when he was writing the article, but he says, to this day, I cannot even look at ice cream. He said, I have difficulty even eating anything that's very sweet. So not only does repeated exposure to the same pleasure become boring, but if we overindulge, it actually becomes nauseating. It actually becomes distasteful. We also never experience full, complete satisfaction. We may experience satisfaction on some levels for some time, but we're not going to experience any happiness from the touch of the senses and the mind with their objects where we can say, wow, now I feel that I have everything I've ever wanted, and it stays like that. We may feel that way for a few minutes or even a few hours or maybe a week, but eventually we no longer feel satisfied. We get satiated. That repeated exposure makes us bored and even nauseated, but we never feel completely satisfied. You see this phenomena in people who've achieved a lot of material success. I remember reading something from Eric Clapton. You all know who Eric Clapton is? And he said by the time he was like 25, you know, he had it all. And he looked around and said, is this all there is? And that's practically a universal theme. of people who achieve what we would consider to be a very high level of material happiness. People who become very rich, they're attractive, they're famous, they're talented, and so forth and so on. You know, they have everything that everybody thinks. If I had all those things, I would feel satisfied. And they look around and say, is that all there is? I mean, I remember going through something like this. How old was I? I don't know. I was a teenager. I was babysitting. 15, 16 maybe. So I was babysitting these kids. They were already asleep. So I'm just in the house. And this was, you know, there was no internet or mobile phones or anything like that. I mean, all I had was a book. I mean, it was television. So I was thinking, what's the purpose of life? I've always been that kind of person. I don't know if all teenagers do that. But. So I was thinking, you know, what's the purpose of life? And I thought about it for a while, and I thought, well, the purpose is to be happy. And I thought, well, am I happy? So I wrote down a list of all the things I had. Well, I have this good thing in my life, and this good thing, and this good thing. I had a long list of all the things I had, and then I looked at that list and said, I guess I must be happy. But that's absurd, isn't it? Then you have to say, well, am I happy? I guess I am. So there isn't this sense of satisfaction. Like we were talking before this class about experiential. You know, you shouldn't have to ask, am I happy? It's as ridiculous as having a meal and then saying, did I eat enough? What do you think? Did I eat enough? Let me look at this list of what I ate. Yeah, I guess I ate enough. Well, one would experience it. So if one's life is really full of satisfaction, one would be experiencing it. So why are all these problems with the happiness that is samsparshaja, born from touch? Why is it to have this dukkha yonaya quality, this giving birth to distress? Well, one of the reasons is that we, the real self, are not experiencing it. So this is from Bhagavad Gita chapter 5, 8 to 9, and there's a very similar verse in the Gita's 13th chapter. A person in the divine consciousness, although engaged in seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, eating, moving about, sleeping, and breathing, always knows within himself that he actually does nothing at all. Now, there are a number of spiritual processes that help us develop this consciousness that we are merely the witness. That the thoughts, the feelings, the desires, the experiences that go through our life are not really happening to us. Gaining a sense of detachment from that certainly brings a sense of peace. Although active spiritual happiness is beyond that. By analogy, we are like a bird in a cage who's trying to become happy by having a clean cage without food. Or a hungry person who's trying to satiate their hunger by putting fuel into their automobile. Our body and mind are external to us. They're something like clothing. They're like a costume or a persona that a person takes on in a drama that is not the actual person. Now, we experience this on some level with the fact that our body and our mental processes have radically changed in our life. So early on, I heard a child in the back. Are they still there? Or did they take them out? So let's say we were able to find all of our baby pictures. And we put the baby pictures up on the wall, and we said, all right, who can match the adults with their baby pictures? It would be difficult, wouldn't it? Same way, you know, if you ever looked in a photo album at pictures of your very elderly grandparents or great-grandparents at, like, their wedding day or something, and you're like, who are these people? I had this rather shocking experience some years ago. There was a photograph in a Back to Godhead magazine of our family. We just had two children at that time. So myself, my husband, and our two older children, when they were very young. And I remember showing it to someone, oh, you know, here's an old picture of me. It was a group of many people in the photograph, and the person looked at me and said, where are you in that photograph? I'm like, whoa. I guess I don't look like I did when I was 25 years old. So we see that the body changes. I mean, according to medical science, the cells in the body keep changing. Every 7 years, we have a completely new set of cells in our body. And our mental processes are also changing. I hope none of us have the same mental processes we had when we were 2 or 3 years old. If you do, you probably need some serious help. So, and we, even in our adult life, right, we change our mental processes. I have a good friend who, you know, used to vote Republican and now votes Democrat. People change. We change our way of thinking. We change our way of looking at the world. Sometimes people make radical changes in how they identify themselves during their life, isn't it? Radical. Even at 30, 40, 50, 60 years. Oh, I've decided I'm like this. But there's still the same sense of I am, isn't there? It's still the same person. So what is that I am that is constant, regardless of how the body changes and regardless of how the mind changes? That is the actual self. And Samsparshaja Bhoga, the happiness that comes from the touch of the body and the mind with objects, has to have all these problems because it has nothing to do with me. An analogy could be if I'm reading a book or I'm watching a movie or a TV show and I'm identifying with the characters, and by that identification I imagine I am feeling the pleasure and pain of the characters, but actually I am not. The character gets a lot of money, but that's not reflected in my bank account. If the character gets, you know, some wonderful, attractive, romantic partner, but I'm still single. Right? It doesn't actually touch me. But while I'm absorbed in the story, the character's happiness feels like my happiness. So while I identify with this body and mind, I think that the happiness of this body and mind are my happiness. But I am just the observer. And this problem of identifying with something that is not me is why material happiness is not satisfying. So many years ago, I was fasting for a day from food and water, and I took a little nap. And during my nap, I was eating a feast in my dream because I was hungry. And also in my dream, I felt very thirsty. And so in my dream, I drank a whole glass of water. Like, you know, I'll just down a glass of water on a really hot day when you're really sweaty. I just drown. And I still felt thirsty. So I drowned another glass of water in my dream, and I still felt thirsty, and another glass of water in my dream, and I still felt thirsty, because I was actually fasting from water, and I was actually thirsty. And then in my dream, I took a gallon jug of water, and I started drinking from the gallon jug. And then you know how it is sometimes in dreams where you have some lucidity? And so all of a sudden in the dream, I thought, something funny's going on here. I can't be drinking a gallon jug of water and still feel thirsty. How is that possible? And then I woke up and I'm like, oh, it was dream water. That moment of lucidity is what happens when people who so-called have everything say, am I happy? Is this all that is? It's that same kind of moment. Wait a minute. I'm drinking water. I should be satisfied. What's the problem? You know, I have the 10 mansions and the gorgeous adulating fans and the private jet and the good health and the... What's that? What? Huh? So those moments of lucidity indicate to us that I, the real I, am not actually touching these sources of pleasure. I'm simply observing them. All right, now we get to, this is a little hard to talk about. It's the kind of thing that we don't want to face. We don't want to acknowledge. It's embarrassing and it's uncomfortable. And if you don't want to face anything like that, there's a door over there and there's a door over there. And I won't judge you. Just say you have a phone call from the Queen of England or something. So if I am identifying with this body and this mind, and I am identifying pleasure as some sparshaja, what's born of touch, and I'm not feeling satisfied, I'm going to have a sense of emptiness and want. Remember that actually I sort of need to cultivate that in order to experience material happiness? That's awful, isn't it? I need to cultivate a sense of emptiness and want and desire in order to experience material happiness. Everybody remember that from the very beginning? Okay, so then I'm going to approach the objects of my senses with a view of taking from them. I cultivated an illusion that I'm the body and mind. That brings me also to cultivate this illusion of emptiness and want, which then has me interacting with my sense objects, which might be other living beings, in a mood of taking. But even if they're not other living beings, even if they're inanimate objects, if we have a sense of taking, look what we've done to the planet. I mean, it's not just human beings exploiting other human beings and human beings exploiting animals. It's also human beings exploiting the dirt and the water and the air. I read a book a while ago, The Alchemy of Air. Fascinating book, by the way. About the development of artificial fertilizer. You know, fertilizer is primarily nitrogen, the air is primarily nitrogen. And how German chemists pulled nitrogen from the air to create artificial fertilizer, which was also used to create weapons. But how this creation of artificial fertilizer has upset the whole balance of nature and caused so much pollution. So exploitation is not just, you know, I'm exploiting a sex object or I'm exploiting an animal. It's also I'm exploiting the soil. I'm exploiting the air. And so a lot of material happiness is based on exploitation. I have a need to fill with this sense object, and therefore I'm going to take it. And a lot of our relationships with other living beings are simply agreements, stated or implicit, that I can exploit you if you can exploit me, and we're going to try to make it as equal as possible. Of course, we don't really try to make it as equal as possible. We're always trying to get a little bit of a better deal. Also, because the body and mind are temporary, even if I say, well, I'm just going to, it's just as good as it gets, you know, I'm just going to be okay with this happiness that's a distress sandwich, and it's exploitive, and it doesn't satisfy me. I'm just going to be okay with that because that's all there is. But we don't even get to keep it. it all goes after a while. So I'd like to play a little game here before we go on to now the good stuff. We're gonna soon finish our depressing part of the presentation, and we're going to get to something that's going to give us what we came for, which is happiness. But let's end this with a little game. All right, so I'd like you to think of all the material happiness that you've ever wanted in your life. Just think at all the desires for all the material happiness you've ever had in your life. For me, it like fills a big football stadium. So of all those things materially you've ever wanted in your life, what percentage did you just like not get at all in any form? Anybody? What percentage did you just not get? We'll start with you. What percentage did you not get? Yeah.
Very small percentage.
Okay. Like what? 5, 10?
No, I mean like I got most of what I need.
You got most of what you need.
Definitely.
2%?
No, I got like a high percentage of what I need.
So what percentage did you not get? 1%? 2%?
5%.
5%. Okay, good. You in the red and white shirt, what percentage of things did you just not get at all? Five, 10. All right, we have some very privileged people in this room. Sometimes I ask people and they say 90%. I mean, it happens. Okay, you in the like blue shirt with the black design, what percent would you say you didn't get at all? 10%. All right. So now let's take the things that you did get. Whatever percent that would be, whether it was 40% or 90%, the things you wanted and you got them, but then they weren't what you expected. Like I had a professor in graduate school, he said when he was 19, somebody came and said, I'm going to teach you how to become a district school superintendent by the time you're 33. Usually people don't become a district superintendent until they're in their 50s. And he gave them a process. Only teach for 3 years and then do this. So he followed it like it was scripture. And lo and behold, he became a district superintendent at 33. And then he discovered he hated being a district superintendent. He said his wife hated it so much she divorced him. He said he realized what he really wanted to be was a teacher. I have a good friend in South Africa who worked hard to become a lawyer, and after she became a lawyer, she found she hated being a lawyer. Or, you know, sometimes you marry that person, you think you love them, once you're married to them, you're like, no. Or you order something, right? You ever done this? You find, you research it, and you, oh, I found what I wanted, and you place the order, and it comes at your doorstep, and you open it up, and you're like, why did I get this? Or maybe even try to use it for a while. You're like, this doesn't do what I wanted. Okay, so of all the things that you wanted and got, what percentage of them were disappointments? So let's see who we're going to take now. Anthony, right? In orange shirt? Yes? What percentage were disappointments?
What percentage of the things I
got were disappointing?
Let's say
half. Half, all right. And you on the end there, what would you say?
Less than
about 40% maybe?
Yeah.
40, okay. And you with the water bottle, what would you say? 50%. All right. So now we have the things that we wanted, we got them, and they're perfect. You're like, yes, it's exactly what I wanted. So I had a Toyota van like this. We bought it used. It was a converted cargo van. And the seats could be put down so they could lie flat. You could actually sleep on those seats. And it had windows put in that had screens in them. So you could have the windows open up screens, you could lie flat, and there was enough room for like 5 or 6 people, but you still had room for luggage in the back. It got great gas mileage, turned on a dime. Absolutely loved that van. Our family took that van on a cross-continental road trip in, I think, 1990. Fantastic vehicle. So one time my daughter and I were driving to the store, and as we were driving, some guy was late for work, didn't stop at a stop sign, and he wrecked our Toyota van. Nobody got hurt. But the van was total. Insurance company said total loss. Of all the things we want, we get, they're perfect. How many of them do we get to keep? What percentage do we get to keep? Everybody?
Zero.
All right, now that we finished our depressing thing. Now let's look at what is actual spiritual happiness. By the way, if any of you here know who Tamal Krishna Goswami is, that was his game, not mine. I learned that from him. So here we have this very nice verse. Ramante yogino nante satchanande chidatmani iti rama padennashu param brahmo vidhiyate. So Rama again means happiness, yogino the yogi, anante, it doesn't have any end. So a translation of this is the supreme absolute truth is called Rama because the transcendentalists take pleasure in the unlimited true pleasure of spiritual existence. It's unlimited and it's authentic. So first thing, it's not a mitigation of distress. One doesn't have to feel any lack, any need, in order to experience this happiness. It exists in and of its own accord. It's a natural part of who we are. It is that fact which is the reason we look for happiness at all, in a way that we can't find it. You might say, if material happiness has all those problems, why do we even look for it? Because we are naturally beings of intrinsic happiness. Just the way if we're in the desert, we would look for water because we're naturally creatures who drink water. So it's a happiness that exists in its own right. It doesn't require something to make one artificially want it. Now, we were saying how with material happiness, you have to get away from it for a while in order to enjoy it again. Right? You have to take a break from pizza to enjoy pizza. You can't have it constantly. Now, in spiritual happiness, there are degrees of union and separation, but they're both experienced as pleasure. If one feels a sense of separation from the divine, that is simply increasing love. And if one has a sense of union with the divine, that is increasing love. They're two different tastes of pleasure. They're not a removal and a coming to, like in material where you enjoy something and then you have to remove yourself from it. The spiritual separation and union is the original relationship with happiness, which we are imitating in our enjoying something and then taking a break from it, and enjoying something and then taking a break from it. So one of the great teachers in our particular line, named Rupa Goswami, he explains different varieties of love for the Supreme and how each of these are experienced in both union and separation, but how each is just a different flavor of happiness. And the spiritual happiness increases with experience. So this is something we're looking for in material happiness. You know, everyone hopes, like if you get married when you're 20 or 25, you know, you're hoping that when you're 85, you're going to have more love for your spouse than when you were 25. And we have these pictures of that, right? The people who, their love increases and increases and increases over time. But generally, the intensity of love and happiness doesn't increase over time. Again, we get accustomed to something. Yeah? It kind of fades into our background. That sense of wonder. The sense of wonder, Rupa Goswami explains, is at the heart of all love. You can't have love, you can't have taste, you can't have pleasure of any kind, of any variety, of any circumstance, without some sense of wonder. Now, because spiritual existence is constantly unfolding and constantly full of new variety, that sense of wonder is always increasing. And therefore, that sense of delight, of exploration, of tasty, delicious mystery and unfolding is always increasing without limit. As compared to this happiness of touch, which gets boring and even revolting, spiritual happiness becomes more and more and more tasty. Again, we have some semblance of that in this world, up to a point. Like if you're going to master a skill, you know, you learn more and more and more and more and more details of the skill, and you increase and you increase and you increase in your mastery and your wonder. But believe me, you reach a point where you're like, I pretty much mastered this. That it starts to be a law of diminishing returns. That after a while, the effort that you have to put into discovering more mysteries and more wonderment about your craft yield fewer and fewer and fewer surprises. And we go on to something else. But when it comes to the spiritual, that never happens. It's explained that Krishna himself is always expanding. And his knowledge of himself and his learning about himself is always a step behind his expansion. He's always discovering more. And we as spiritual beings are also in that mood, in our spiritual happiness. More sweetness, more delight, more beauty, more fascination, more mysteries to unfold. And it's our direct experience. One of the ways you can tell what is a genuine spiritual experience is this sense of authenticity. There's a qualitative difference between the happiness that comes from the touch of our various senses and our mind with their objects and the happiness experienced by the real self. So when I was about 20, I guess, 19 or 20, so we were living in New York, and some friend of the ashram there had a peach orchard and said, we've already harvested all of the peaches. If you guys would like to come out and get the ones that we missed, because we harvested them mechanically. So there's always peaches left on the tree that the machines didn't get, and there's some perfectly good peaches that have fallen to the ground, and if you come right away, they won't have started to rot or get bugs in them. So we got this big truck and we went out to the guy's orchard and we filled up with these peaches. And they were all organically grown and they were all tree ripened. So we had boxes of them and we're driving the truck back to the ashram in Brooklyn. And our son was, I don't know, about a year old or something. He's sitting on my lap and he asked for a peach, you know, can I have a peach? So I give him a peach, and like most children that age, he didn't finish it. You know, took a few bites out of it. So I finished it, and I realized I'd never had a real peach before in my life. I should tell you this funny story. So I was, years ago, I was in Melbourne, and the people who were, I was a guest there, and various different families were cooking lunch for me, and all the people cooking for me had been born and raised in India. So in Australia, they were buying peaches and plums from the market, but they weren't familiar with those fruits. So they didn't know what a ripe peach or plum was supposed to be like. And you know, often in the grocery stores they sell unripe fruit because they transport it unripe. So they're buying unripe fruit and they thought that was the way you were supposed to eat it. So they were making me these fruit salads with cut up rock hard plums and peaches. You know, and they just thought that's what it's supposed to be. And similarly, until I went to that orchard, I'd always had fruit that had been picked unripe and shipped unripe and ripened in the house, you know, flown in from Chile or something. I had never in my life eaten a locally grown, tree-ripened, organic fruit. And I was astonished. It was real. You know, another example, and I wrote a poem about this some time ago, like you go to the grocery stores And there's these bottles of colored flavored water, you know, whatever they're called, juicy juice, you know, and 1% fruit juice. I can never figure out why Hawaiian Air serves that stuff on their planes. Hawaiian Air, they should be serving you real fruit juice. And you look at the little, it says guava juice, you know, these little plastic cups with those metal things on the top, and you pull it off. 10% guava. I remember also when I was in Trinidad, and most of our members there had fruit and vegetables growing in their yards, and for our Sunday feast program, they would all just bring the produce from their yards, and everybody had a free cup of, you know, passion fruit juice, picked ripe and fresh right out of their backyard. You know, something you paid $2 for in a health food store. But we can tell what's authentic, isn't it? Right? If you get this like 1% colored flavored water, and then you actually eat a watermelon, you just know that it's authentic. How do you know? I don't know how you know, but we know. This is the real thing, and it's like that with spiritual happiness. You experience it and you go, what was that? Let me give you some practical examples we find in our Hare Krishna society. So we cook vegetarian food, pure vegetarian food, and we offer it to the Lord. And when we offer it to the Lord, it becomes imbued with spiritual potency. And when that happens, it takes on a flavor that can't be explained by the material ingredients. So I had this experience in Puerto Rico. I was speaking at the University of San Juan. And that morning, one of my friends had made cookies for the program. And I was in the kitchen while she was making the cookies. So I saw how she made the cookies. Butter, sugar, flour. Maybe it was some vanilla, baking soda, like as basic as you could get and still call it a cookie. Like if you eliminated any of those ingredients, it wouldn't be a cookie anymore, any of you from the UK, biscuit. So it was really, really simple. So we take it to the University of San Juan, and I gave my talk, about 150 people. And afterwards, I'm answering questions, so I didn't get to eat any of the cookies. You know, they were giving out like cookies and drinks, and they were all gone by the time I finished answering questions. And I started getting all these people coming up to me and saying, could you give me the recipe for those cookies? You know, one person says it, okay. 20, 30, 40 people asking me for the recipe for the cookies, and I'm thinking, what? Because when the food is offered to Krishna, it has the taste of God. Or in our kirtan. In our kirtan, we're chanting Hare Krishna or other mantras. And you can experience something in the kirtan that you can't explain by the musical expertise of the singers and the instrument players. You know, we've all experienced the happiness of beautiful music, expertly done music. But you're experiencing this happiness in the kirtan and you're thinking, that drum player isn't that good. I mean, he's good, okay, but he's not that. I mean, the singer's nice, but, you know, I don't think people would be paying $200 at Carnegie Hall to go listen to her. How am I experiencing this? Where is it coming from? Or you read the Bhagavad Gita. And we've all read, I'm sure, philosophical books or self-help books, and you know, we find some intellectual, mental stimulation, but you're reading the Bhagavad Gita and you're going, wait a minute, what am I experiencing? I'm experiencing something that I can't explain just by a very intellectual or philosophically satisfying experience. Or even just doing some basic service for the pleasure of the Supreme. That's simple, washing a pot, cleaning a toilet, driving a car, milking a cow, and then you're experiencing something. It's like, you know, okay, I mean, can cleaning toilets be that much fun? I mean, like, what's going on here? we know that we're experiencing authentic spiritual happiness when it qualitatively feels different than any of the happiness by touch, and when we cannot explain the quality of that happiness by whatever material touch sensations are also involved in the experience. And once you taste that, probably shouldn't tell you this, it's all over. Then you'll know, no, it's not all there is. There's something higher. There's something else. It isn't just the big house with the fancy cars and the flat screen TV and the adulating fans and the beautiful partner. It's not just that. There's something else. And once you know there's something else, you'll never be satisfied with the shadow. Therefore, Rupa Goswami says, if you want to be satisfied with the shadow, don't taste the spiritual. It will ruin it for you. You won't be able to go back to drinking the dream water. And it is actually fully satisfying, but not satiating. Material pleasure is satiating, but not satisfying. Spiritual pleasure is satisfying, but not satiating. You never feel like I've got enough. At the same time, you're fully satisfied. This particular picture is of a boy named Dhruva. He was a king's son, but I'm sure as many of you have experienced, or you know people have experienced, I experienced this, he was disinherited by a step-parent. I was personally disinherited by my stepmother. Lovely lady. May she rest in peace. So he was disinherited by his stepmother, and he was very angry at this. And he decided, I should have been the king, I should have inherited the kingdom, and I am going to pray to the Lord to get a kingdom better than my father's. I'm going to show him. So he went to the forest to perform yoga with the idea of using yoga to become materially successful. But when he actually saw the Lord, when he actually experienced the spiritual happiness of his practice, he said, I was looking for broken pieces of glass, but I found a diamond. He said, now I feel completely satisfied and I'm embarrassed that I ever looked for anything within this world. Then spiritual happiness is not exploitive. It's actually based on real love. Because it's fully satisfying and fully fulfilling, that happiness is based on giving. It's like you have an unlimited spring. Here on the property we have a spring. So it's like if you have this unlimited spring in your heart that was constantly overflowing you with fresh, clean, pure water that you could then share with others without any diminishing for yourself. So this kind of sharing, you know, kind of if you were, you know, what are these people, these billionaires? Of course, their wealth is also limited. But you know, these billionaires that practically couldn't spend all their money in their life, they could be, practically speaking, giving it away, and they would still have something. Of course, that's not absolutely true. But spiritually, that's absolutely true. You can be giving it away, and as long as you're in touch with the source, and as long as you're experiencing that happiness, so there's no question of exploiting anybody. It's not based on a feeling of need. It's not based on a feeling of emptiness. It's not based on a feeling of lack. It's based on a feeling of fulfillment. And because we, the soul, are eternal, spiritual happiness is also eternal. It doesn't end even with death. There's no end, and therefore there's no fear. With our material happiness, there's always fear. My perfect Toyota van is not going to last forever, you know. So while I'm enjoying it, it's mixed with fear. The analogy is like if you have some pudding, but you put sand in it. So material happiness is always mixed with this fear that it's temporary. When am I going to lose it? When am I going to lose it? But spiritual, it's the nature of the soul. So there's no fear. There's no anxiety mixed with it. Then also, it's full of variety. And this fact is something that a lot of people who have a genuine spiritual path don't take this final step to understanding the variety of spiritual life. Spiritual life and spiritual happiness is ultimately personal, with personal relationships with Krishna and personal relationships with other souls that are the perfection of what we are looking for in personal individual relationships in this world. So Krishna is inviting us, why don't we try spiritual happiness? And he ends the Bhagavad Gita with saying, deliberate on this fully, and then do what you wish to do. So I hope you enjoyed this presentation. So we have about a half an hour for questions, comments, arguments. We have, I think, a traveling mic. Good. And happiness from accomplishments would be a happiness of the mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have done this, I have built this, I have made this, therefore I am happy. I think of it like the happiness of a picture. It's like, you know, you take a picture, you know, they have these commercials for cars or even laundry soap or whatever. And they show this, you know, happy family in this beautiful house. And it's like you kind of take this picture of your accomplishment and you put it up and go, see how happy I am? But I'm glad you came out the other side. Very good. Of when it was, I think it was in 1996. So I had one of my frequent talks with the Lord, and I said to him, Krishna, you know, you've taught me a lot of good lessons through suffering, like you're talking about lesson you went through suffering. You know, I've learned a lot of good things through suffering, and no doubt, a lot of good lessons, you know, appreciate that, grateful for that. But, you know, I'm a teacher, I'm a professional teacher, and I could list 40, 50 teaching methods. You know, you've got to have more than one. You can't just have one. Would you try another method on me? Let's try the teach Urmila through ecstasy method. Give it a try. And I said, but I'm going to do my end of the bargain. Because misery often gets our attention. Right? I said, I'll pay attention. I said, I make you a promise. Whatever you try to teach me, I'll listen and I'll do it. All right. And then, of course, as it is with such things, you forget about that you had that conversation. So, should I tell you the whole story?
Yes.
I told it before publicly and recorded, but it is a little embarrassing. Because it was a lesson, and so, yeah, like that. All right, so I had dedicated my life to work for children's education. Altogether, I spent 27 years teaching children. And I very much thought of myself as a champion of children's education. It was one of the things about myself that I was the most proud of, and proud being a very clear operative word there, that I really thought that this was something glorious about myself. I also thought that it was an incredibly spiritual thing. All right. So I was asked to go to Europe and work on an encyclopedia about Krishna consciousness. Now, the things that make me happiest are researching, studying, analyzing, putting together lessons and teaching. That's the things I love the most in my life, where kind of time and space goes away and I get into a flow and like that. So this is what I was being asked to do. I was asked to do in-depth research and writing. I was putting together a whole electronic encyclopedia of the Krishna consciousness movement, the philosophy, the practice, everything. And I was given all facility. It was in Denmark, out in the country. Beautiful, beautiful place in the country. I had a gorgeous room to stay in. I mean, it looked like it was, you know, an interior decorator had designed it. I had all first-class equipment. Somebody cooked for me. Somebody did my... They weren't paying me, but I didn't. Well, it wasn't the way I operate usually. So somebody cooked for me. Somebody did my laundry. The people who I was working with were all wonderful, incredible people. The whole team that was working on this, there was good synergy. There was respect. There was great communication. It was just... Like, if I wanted to design absolutely the perfect work situation for me, this was it. Every single aspect about it. Oh, and then because it was an electronic encyclopedia, it was going to be on a DVD, so there were certain layout constraints, and you had to put the information into certain size boxes. First time I appreciated the people who work in museums and zoos who put the information on those little plaques. I never thought about it before. You know, you get one letter too much, it doesn't fit. You get to think of how am I going to say what I want to say so that I say everything that I need to say, but it fits. But I love puzzle solving. And I love solving puzzles. So I was just like cloud nine. All right. So I am completely happy. No, there was no misery. I mean, there was like absolutely, there was nothing miserable going on here at all. It was all just wonderful. All right. So the reason they were putting this whole encyclopedia together was for fundraising. It was a fundraising tool to build a huge temple in India, which is now being built. And so I was doing all parts of this, and then I came to the part where I had to write about the temple that they wanted to raise funds for. And all of a sudden, I was blocked. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't write anything. I was completely stymied for one whole day, and I was only there for 3 weeks, and I had to get it all done during that time. It was like putting in 14-hour days, and to lose a day was a big deal, and I lost this day. I couldn't do anything. Just like, why? What's the problem? And then the Lord in my heart kind of opened the door and said, you're envious. You don't want that money to go to the temple in India. You want it to go to children's education. And I went, whoa. And this dedication, I could feel that what I had understood as my dedication to children's education was only, what was it? Pride. It was only pride. It was how I thought I was better than other people.
Well, they don't care about the children. They just care about the building. But me, I care about the children. I want them.
That was all it was. I ended up writing a poem about it. The jewel on the altar is a garbage heap. That what I thought I was giving to the Lord, what I thought I was giving to my guru, I thought I'm giving a diamond of my dedication, it wasn't. Now, that realization was painful. I had to face something ugly about myself that I had been hiding from myself for a long time. So, yes, there was, but it was very momentary because I immediately remembered what I had prayed 2 weeks before I had been invited to Denmark, and I'm like, oh, this is it! You're teaching me something in the context of happiness. And I told you I'd listen. So I'm going to. And I said, I accept. And there was a part of my mind going, don't accept, don't accept, don't accept. If you accept this, you'll stop caring about the children because you'll lose all of your motivation and you just won't be anything anymore. You'll just be sitting around depressed. Everything that drives you will be gone and it will be terrible. And I'm like, I don't care. I accept. I fully release the pride. I fully release the envy. Whatever the consequences, if it means my life is finished, my mission is finished, if it means I'm just an empty shell, I don't care. I'm not holding on to this anymore. I let go. I had maybe 5 minutes of suffering. Maybe. Maybe it was only 2. And as soon as I did that, it's like the analogy I give, you know, I talk about having a spring in the heart. It's like, let's say that you've got this spring inside you, and it's at the bottom of a basin, but somehow where the spring would come out, you have a plug. And you remove the plug, and there's, so I was just filled. And by the way, I did not lose my dedication to children's education. I just did it on a much happier platform. And I'm fine that people can have money for other things too. That's awesome. That's totally cool. And other people can be dedicated to other things. And not everybody has to be dedicated to what I'm dedicated to. That would be a very flat world. So ask, moral of this, ask. But you have to be willing to learn through happiness. The push isn't as strong. It takes more volition from your side. You follow? But it's worth it. Now, has he always taught me through happiness since then? No, there are some things that, you know, I'm like really stubborn about, I suppose. But more and more, mostly. One analogy I give, I don't know how many of you know much about Krishna, but he takes care of cows. And when he wants to bring the cows from one place to another, he calls them by name. And if they don't come when he calls them by name, then he plays his flute. Do you know how herders, cow herders and shepherds, they often have instruments? So he plays his flute. If they don't come when he plays his flute, he also has a rope. And if they don't come when he has a rope, he also has a stick. So what I say is, listen for your name. Don't make him get out the stick. At least come with the flute. And Krishna would much, much, much prefer if we come easily. How many of you have children? Wouldn't you prefer if they did the right thing when you asked them nicely the first time? Do you want to give them a timeout and take their fire truck away? Is that what you want to do? No, of course not. Please stop hitting your brother with a fire truck. You know, you're hurting your little brother. Would you put the fire truck down, please? I'm sorry, I'm taking the fire truck away. You're not going to have it for an hour. Now please tell your... You're right? So, like that. Does that answer your question? Yes. You need to speak a lot louder. Barely.
Better.
Shri Krishna, my question is about happiness. So for material world, it's easy to decide whether I'm happy, I'm in misery, I'm angry, whatever. But for spiritual world, how do we make out myself or somebody else who is happy or not so happy?
It's interesting you ask that, because I guess I see it the opposite. I see it with material life, it's a lot harder to tell whether or not I'm happy. Because it's so mixed.
It's mixed, but still, you know, if you have good education, hopefully that's something to be happy about. If you have a good job, that's something to be happy about. Not a good job.
See, I see that as just the picture. It's a photograph. I can take a picture of how much money I have in the bank, and I look at that. Oh, look, I'm happy. I can take a picture of my degrees, and you know, I have my. So let's say, I mean, nobody would put their bank balance up on the wall, but let's just say you did that. Let's just say, you know, you have to have a picture of your diplomas on your wall. And let's say you had one, you know, some real-time bank balance that was constantly changing as your investments were going up. I don't know right now if that's the case for many of you. But anyway, right now that's probably not what's happening. But, you know, you look at your investments going up, and then you have another picture of your happy family members. And then you can take a picture of your car. Maybe you got a swimming pool. You know, and then you have like your kids' trophies. Maybe you've got your trophies. And you look at all that and you go, I'm happy. That's what I did when I was babysitting. It's exactly what I did. Except I just wrote it on a piece of paper. I wrote everything on a piece of paper. I have this, I have this, I have this, I have this. I guess I'm happy. But that's not happiness. It's some mental idea. But spiritually, you feel this expansive joy. Now, this is a deep subject which I'm not going to get a chance probably to go into today. But spiritual happiness, as I said briefly, it has variety. All the material emotions, even the so-called negative ones, have a place in spiritual happiness. It's not just like, I'm blissful. That's boring. It's full of variety, like lots and lots of flavors of ice cream, but they're all ice cream. Spiritual happiness, you are experiencing it as a soul, it's not a picture. It's undeniable. You can't deny it. You don't wonder about it. You're not like, am I experiencing spiritual happiness or not? Materially, it's like that. Got all these pictures on the wall. Am I happy or not? I guess so. This is what they told me would make me happy, so I guess I am. Yeah, sure. Does that help? Well, at least I got a little bit.
Yeah,
not so much. Yes. Well, I already gave you a little idea of what internally I've done to get there. You know, internally, there's a positive and negative. The positive is internally, I have cultivated deliberately, repeatedly, daily, over and over again, absorption in spiritual topics. And a willingness, and that took a while, that wasn't immediate by any means, but a willingness to face the things that I was holding onto internally that were impediments and to let go of them.
which were not always things. They were generally ways of thinking and ways of behaving and ways of thinking about myself. If you want to talk about external practices, I do mantra meditation every day, hour and a half, 2 hours. I study sacred literatures every day in depth. That's one of the main things I do. I have a sacred space in my home, or when I travel, I have a traveling sacred space where I do meditation and worship. And I do my best with a lot of kindness to myself for the fact that I constantly fail to act in a way that is kind and respectful to others. Not for the inner satisfaction of doing that, but for the sake of love for Krishna. And what does it feel like? Well, in little bits, it just feels like, how does one, the authentic form of whatever one experiences materially, the real form of it. Like it's still juice, but it's real juice instead of chemical juice. If you can think of it's friendship, but it's real friendship. It's wonder, but it's real wonder. And the most extreme situations, we have a term in Sanskrit, achintabheda-bheda-tattva. Achintabheda-bheda-tattva, achinta means inconceivable. It's somewhat describable, but not fully describable. Bheda-abheda, that there's simultaneous absolute oneness and difference. That we and Krishna are absolutely, totally, completely the same, and we are absolutely, totally, completely different. And to experience that simultaneously. To experience God as if he is me and I am him, and at the same time, I am myself experiencing him and he is himself experiencing me. And as I said yesterday in my talk to one of the groups, that, you know, we imitate that in this world, particularly sex is a kind of imitation of that, where two people try to become one while remaining themselves. And another imitation of that would be the relationship between parent and child, especially mother and child, I think especially in pregnancy and breastfeeding, where you feel like you're one with the child, but yet you're not. The difference with a child is that the child is not experiencing, the child in the womb and the child at the breast is not developed enough in awareness to have it be a fully reciprocal relationship. And we feel that to some extent in friendship. We can feel that to some extent in nature, that we feel a oneness with nature, but yet we're a distinct person. So we have some idea of the concept, and it's definitely something that we try to achieve. We try to achieve something where we feel completely unified with someone or someone's at the same time having a sense of self. So that when experienced with God, it is the perfection of what we are looking for. And I think that's the best I can do. I mean, I don't have my poetry immediately available, but that would probably express it better than trying to express it in prose. Yes?
What does one person do? What does someone do if someone is on a spiritual path or they're constantly growing and trying to always internally check in with, you know, how your behavior is, and you're surrounded by other family members and friends that just are stagnant and just have no growth, and they are into material things. And how do you live or find balance in a situation where there's conflict?
So there's a very nice section in the Bhagavad Gita, it's chapter 12. I should have this totally memorized by now, anyway.
I don't. Chapter 12, text 13 through 20, is a list of where Krishna says what's dear to him. And these are ways that we connect with spirituality, and these are ways we can practice anywhere. They're not always easy, but they're worth working on. One who is not envious, but is a kind friend to all living entities. I mean, just that people always ask me, you know, this question in some form or another is one of the top five questions I get all over the world. Just to be non-envious of others and to be a kind friend to everybody for the sake of loving Krishna, not for the sake of getting praised for it. That's in what we call rajas. And not for the sake of feeling happy and equipoised within, which is what we would call sattva. But for the sake of actually having a loving relationship with the divine. One who is not envious but is a kind friend to all living entities, who does not think himself a proprietor. So I'm not the proprietor of my friends and family. I'm not this person's wife. I'm not this person's mother. I'm not this person's sister. I'm not this person's daughter. That's just the body. I'm not a proprietor. I don't have any claims on these people. And is free from false ego. False ego is thinking, I am this body, I am this identity, I am this mind. Who is equal in both happiness and distress. If you're experiencing spiritual happiness, the happiness and distress of this world is equally uninteresting. You're neutral towards it. Who is tolerant. Tolerant does not mean repressed. It means detached and equipoised, right? It doesn't mean repressed, right? Always satisfied. Again, that's not repression. It's not numbness. Self-controlled, which is again not numbness, not repression. He for whom no one, this is a really interesting one. He for whom no one is put into difficulty and who is not disturbed by anyone. He for whom no one is put into difficulty and who is not disturbed by anyone. Who is equipoised in happiness and distress, again. Fear and anxiety, who's not dependent on the ordinary course of activities. So it's not that everything has to go according to plan or everything has to go the way I want it in order for me to feel peaceful and satisfied. Who is pure, expert, without cares, and Srila Prabhupada's comment on this, without cares, he said, don't join any faction, don't join any group, don't identify yourself with this party and this group and this faction and that faction. Free from all pains. You were talking about physical pain. And by the way, even physical pain is an opinion of the brain. Not striving for some result. You were talking about achievement, right? I want to achieve something. I have to get some result. No, I'm doing things for in the present moment. My connection with the divine. How can I connect with the divine in this moment, whether the ultimate result is something I can put up on my wall or not? One who neither rejoices nor grieves, who neither laments nor desires, this is speaking materially, and who renounces both auspicious and inauspicious things, one who is equal to friends and enemies. That's hard. I just recently had a revelation that some person in my life had performed a horrific crime. And all of a sudden, I thought it was hard to not think of this person as an enemy. It was a struggle. My initial gut reaction is, I hope this person dies a miserable death. And it was a pretty horrific thing. And it was to step back from that and say, okay, well, that's a natural materialistic reaction to somebody really doing some horrific criminal thing and betrayal. But that's not what I want to be. That's hurting myself. May this person learn what they have to learn through joy.
Oh, that's another way of not learning through misery. Don't want other people to learn through misery. That's a biggie. Karma is very subtle. If you want anyone who's hurt you to learn through suffering, you will also have to learn through suffering. That's how it works. Want your enemies to learn through joy. That's an item of forgiveness. Forgiveness doesn't mean they didn't do anything wrong. This person does need to answer for his crimes. So that doesn't mean that the person did nothing wrong, but it means that you want them to learn in the most joyful way possible. And what we want for others very much boomerangs back to ourselves. So one who is equal to friends and enemies, you want good for your friends and you want good for your enemies. Who is equipoised in honor and dishonor. Your friends and relatives say nice things about you, they don't say nice things about you. It has nothing to do with you, your soul. Heat and cold, happiness and distress, arrogant. Fame and infamy. Who is always free from contaminating association, always silent and satisfied with anything. Again, that's not repression. Who doesn't care for any residence, fixed in knowledge. So that we can practice anywhere. Will we be perfect at it in the next 5 minutes? Probably not. Will we be perfect at it in the next 50 years? Probably not. But that we're making an effort to do that draws grace to us. And it does become easier and easier and easier and easier, and it becomes part of who we are. And then we can just have compassion without pride, without condensation. You follow? That I've also been a materialistic fool, so why should I be high and mighty about somebody who's right now a materialistic fool? Let me just have compassion. I hope they come to happiness, but my happiness is not dependent on their anything. My happiness is not dependent on anything external. It really isn't. Yes. And then I think we have to end.
Yeah.
Or maybe we have to end right now. Oh, we have to end right now. I'm sorry. All right. I'm sorry. Any of you who had something more to say? So I hope that you got something out of this. And anything that you did get out of this is good. I owe to my own spiritual teacher, A.C. Bhaktivinoda Swami Prabhupada. Anything that was bad is my responsibility. And please just forget about that part. So again... Thank you very much.